when I was collecting the bios as the chair of the Sunday Service Committee, I didn't realize I was going to be doing the introducing as well. And I'm looking at this. Our speaker today, Heather Lau, has been a member of our congregation for about a year. About a year? And you're also a member of the Sunday Service Committee? Why? Are we ever lucky to have her? She's married with three children and three dogs. Her family owns and operates a pet sitting service in Regina. Heather is passionate about living peacefully and empowering people to be independent.
Okay, so this is the first long presentation I've done since grade 12, so please be kind to me. All right. My presentation is a part of the famous Unitarian series and is based on information presented about her life on A&E's biography series, a biography of her life written by Lynn Scher called Failure is Impossible, and websites like Wikipedia and the official website for the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House in New York. Susan B. Anthony was a pioneer crusader for the woman suffrage movement in the United States and president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association. Her work helped pave the way for the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, giving women the right to vote. I first became interested in Susan B. Anthony when I saw the movie Iron-Jawed Angels. It's a film that tells the story of women in the United States and their struggle to get the vote. Although Susan B. Anthony is not portrayed in the film, one of the characters talks about her with such reverence that I really had to find out more. And from what I have discovered as I learn more about her life, the deep admiration shown in that film is well deserved. Her accomplishments were vast, and her passion for human rights for all people was intoxicating to those around her. Susan B. Anthony was born on February 15, 1820, in Adams, Massachusetts. Her family were Quakers and were very active politically. They worked to end slavery in what was called the abolitionist movement, often holding meetings in their living room with lively discussions about how to bring about that change. They were also part of the temperance movement, which wanted the production and sale of alcohol limited or stopped completely. It was in this environment that Susan was formed, steeped in a very loving family who longed for change and were quite active in bringing it about. I believe the reason she was able to effect so much change and empower those around her was not just because of her individual skills and talent, but because of the incredibly close-knit family connections and the support she drew from them and her friends, and the influence that they had on her throughout her lifetime. Her family was full of individuals who were feisty and strong-willed and did not shrink back from a challenge. Her parents were married in spite of coming from different religious backgrounds, something that was frowned upon at the time. According to Wikipedia, Anthony's father was an abolitionist and a temperance advocate. A Quaker, he had a difficult relationship with his traditionalist congregation, which rebuked him for marrying a non-Quaker and then disowned him for allowing a dance school to operate in his home. He continued to attend Quaker meetings anyway and became even more radical in his beliefs. Anthony's mother was not a Quaker, but helped raise their children in a more tolerant version of her husband's religious tradition. Their father encouraged them all, girls as well as boys, to be self-supporting, teaching them business principles and giving them responsibilities at an early age. And one of the interesting stories around their marriage was that Susan's mother was quite an accomplished singer, but in order to show deference to his faith when they married, she stopped singing. She never even sang lullabies for her babies, just to try and make the transition more comfortable for the family. Susan was the oldest of seven brothers and sisters. Two of her brothers moved to Kansas to support the anti-slavery movement there, with one actively fighting in the Bleeding Kansas Crisis, a precursor to the Civil War. and the other starting a newspaper there and eventually becoming mayor of Leavenworth. And the Bleeding Kansas crisis is just incredible when I started reading up on that. And it really goes to show the bravery in her family, that they would just on purpose go right into such a dangerous situation. Her sister Mary, with whom she shared a house as an adult, and as she grew older, was a school teacher and a principal herself. And by the end of her life, she was demanding a salary equivalent to that of men who were in the same position at the time, which was quite unusual. Active is an excellent description of Susan and her entire network of family and friends, many of whom were greatly accomplished in their own right. It has been difficult to wrap my mind around her biography, achievements, and activities because of the variety and scope of projects and social justice causes she had on the go all at the same time. Her family well prepared her for a life of activism. She was highly educated, including some homeschooling by her father when he felt frustrated by the limitations of the local schoolhouse. She was quite a bright student, and at one point she was finished all of her work and she went up to her teacher and asked him if she could get some division problems because she was interested in learning division. And he said there was no reason that a woman would ever need to know division. And so when she came home and told her family about that, her father pulled the kids out of the local school and began to homeschool them himself. And she went on to go to some private schools, and before an economic depression forced her to come back home. She valued her family as her dearest possession. Her work with political activism began with the abolition of slavery. The entire family was involved in the abolitionist movement, and Susan was out collecting anti-slavery petition signatures when she was 17 years old. And in her journal, she describes outfitting slaves for the Underground Railroad with her friend Harriet Tubman. So she's very active. Her early involvement in abolitionism and watching the success of that movement was a spark that ignited her to further action in the areas of prohibition and women's rights. She said, "Cautious, careful people, always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing, never can bring about reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly or privately, in season and out, avow their sympathy with despised and persecuted ideas and their advocates, and bear the consequences." Because of her experiences collecting signatures for the abolitionist movement, she came to realize that a signature on a petition was of little value unless that signature represented a vote. When her family moved to Rochester, her family began to attend the Unitarian Church there. In regards to the family connection with the Unitarian Church, she had this to say in her later life. "One of the pleasantest memories of Rochester, my home, the past 40 years, are associated with the ministers and friends. Under the preaching of my revered friend, William Barry Channing, my spirit was born anew. For the first time in my life, I listened to an educated, cultured presentation of the doctrines of Friends of the Light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. It was during Mr. Channing's ministrations that my dear Quaker father contributed his first $10 for the support of a lively ministry so contrary to the testimonies of his religious sect. And it was there that my father and my mother and my now only sister Mary regularly attended church." Through their involvement in the church, Susan's parents and her sister Mary attended a conference held at the Unitarian Church on the topic of women's rights. Susan wasn't able to attend that because she was working. Her father then began to strongly encourage Susan to adopt that as one of her causes. She laughed at his enthusiasm and remembers thinking that although she had little interest in voting, she was very interested in getting equal pay for equal work. At that time, she was living in another city, working as a school teacher and sending money back home to her family to help them get by. She was very upset to learn that the man who had held her position prior to her made four times what she was being paid. Anthony was further inspired to fight for women's rights while campaigning against alcohol. And I just wanted to point out here that for those who have Netflix, there is quite an interesting documentary series about the prohibition movement, and it really encompasses a lot of women's rights issues because women were really at the mercy of the men in their family, and so alcoholism affected them in ways that I don't think can even really comprehend today. She was denied a chance to speak at a temperance convention because she was a woman. When she stood up to make her presentation to the gathering, the conversation devolved into a debate about whether or not it was appropriate for a woman to speak in public. Susan had grown up in a Quaker community where women were given much more rights than they received in the outside community. She had watched her aunt give talks at their Sunday Quaker meetings without any fuss made over it. So the situation at the temperance meeting was quite upsetting, and Susan was outraged at her poor treatment and left. To give you an idea of the situation in regards to women's rights at that time, when Susan B. Anthony was alive, women were at the mercy of their husbands and fathers and the other men in their family. They were not allowed to own property, vote, hold office, or work in many careers. They could not own a business, have a bank account, get a divorce without their husband's consent, or maintain custody of their children. They could not serve on juries, so they were not judged by a jury of their peers should they ever be on trial. In the words of a later suffragist, Alice Paul, "We don't make the laws, but we have to obey them like children." It was around this time that Susan became friends with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was a huge inspiration to her. Susan became like an aunt to Elizabeth's children, spending time at their home and planning and organizing with their mother. Susan had the drive and freedom as an unmarried woman to rally the masses, and Elizabeth was an incredible speaker and wrote many of the speeches that Susan delivered. Many accounts remark that Elizabeth spent more time with Susan than she did with her own husband. Lynn Scherer, her biographer, describes their collaboration. They became the indivisible odd couple of the American women's rights movement. Stanton, the short, stout mother of seven, with a quick wit and a facile pen. Anthony, the tall, slim spinster who tended toward the serious and agonized over setting words on paper. But underneath Stanton's white curls and Anthony's gray bun functioned two brains in search of one goal, women's rights, obtainable only through the vote. For more than half a century, they led the charge together, sustaining an enviably fulfilling relationship that survived vast distances and occasional strains, but never lessened in intensity. Anthony called Stanton my oldest and longest tried woman friend. Henry Stanton, Elizabeth's husband, summarized the team: Elizabeth stirs up Susan, and Susan stirs the world. Susan studied the Constitution and went on speaking tours to advocate for women to get the vote. And that seems to have been one of the few options available to women at that time. Even with abolitionism and the temperance movement, she did some speaking tours as well. She often delivered as many as 100 speeches a year, having to spend a lot of time apart from her beloved family to do so. In order to stand out from the crowd and be easily spotted by the press when she arrived to do a speech, she took to wearing a red shawl to become easily recognizable. Over time, her red shawl became something of a trademark. In fact, Lynn Scherer tells this anecdote. Her red shawl became such a cherished symbol of the venerable leader that even the usually cynical Washington press corps was swept along. In 1898, when she chose instead a white shawl for one session of the suffrage convention, the newspaperman sent her a note that read, "No red shawl, no report." Anthony gamely played along, telling them, "All right, boys, I'll send to the hotel for it." When it arrived and she placed it around her shoulders, the audience burst into applause and the reporters took up their pencils. Along with activist Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Anthony founded the National Woman Suffrage Association in 1869. Around this time, the two created and produced The Revolution, a weekly publication that lobbied for women's rights. Later, the pair edited 3 volumes of history of women's suffrage together, and that was a huge project that took years. Susan had an intense devotion to the cause and refused to distract from it in any way. So even though there were some clothing styles that were becoming popular among the feminist population, like a type of pant called a bloomer, so you wouldn't have to wear the big long dresses, and having shorter hair, she chose to have a more conservative presentation so as not to distract from her message. By remaining unmarried, not only was she able to preserve some of her personal rights, because I'm not totally clear on this, but I believe women had some rights to have sign contracts and own some property until they became married, and then all of it went to their husband. So by remaining unmarried, she was able to have some of those freedoms, and also her time was her own, so she was able to work much harder on all the causes she was interested in. Anthony was tireless in her efforts, giving speeches around the country to convince others to support a woman's right to vote. She even took matters into her own hands in 1872 when she voted in the presidential election illegally. Anthony was arrested and tried unsuccessfully to fight the charges. The judge at her trial would not even allow her to testify in her own defense, saying she was incompetent to appear because she was a woman. She ended up being fined $100, a fine she never paid. After the sentence was pronounced, she said to the judge, "May it please your honor, I shall never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty. I shall earnestly and persistently continue to urge all women to the practical recognition of the old revolutionary maxim that resistance to tyranny is obedience to God." After the trial, she had thousands of transcripts of the trial printed up, and she distributed them around the country when she did her speeches. She even traveled to Europe and helped organize the first International Council of Women. On her 75th birthday, she was surprised by, at the celebration, they had a procession of 75 children, black and white, come and put a rose in her lap as they went by her. And on her 80th birthday, she was invited to celebrate it at the White House, where she was a regular guest, actually, in spite of not having achieved the vote for women before her death. She was a regular speaker at the White House, and they used to joke about how spring was no longer heralded in by the red-breasted robin, but by the red-shawled Susan Anthony coming to speak to the members. The last words that Susan spoke in public were at her 86th birthday party. "Failure is impossible." And I also want to say that she was extremely encouraged by the fact that when she first was born, there were no women in colleges. They were not accepted in colleges in the U.S. And as she saw more and more colleges accepting women into their programs, it was a huge, it was very exciting for her. And that is where the "failure is impossible" quote, I believe, first came from, is one of her speeches to a graduating class of female students. When Anthony died on March 13th, 1906, women still did not have the right to vote. It wasn't until 1920, 14 years after her death, that the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, giving all adult women the right to vote, was passed. And the 19th Amendment is often referred to as the Susan B. Anthony Amendment in her honor. 5 months later, millions of women across the United States stepped into the voting booth for the first time. In recognition of her dedication and hard work, the U.S. Treasury Department put Anthony's portrait on the $1 coins in 1979, making her the first woman to be so honored. And one of the things that I find the most inspiring about her is that looking at herself and her family, they're not perfect. Her father had a variety of different jobs. They all worked hard to support the family. They weren't wealthy for that time. And it was just nice to see that it's about trying. It's about making the effort. It's not about doing it perfectly. Some of her positions were very hardline and, you know, off-putting to some of the people around her, but she kept her focus very strong on getting the vote for women. And I'll just close with a little poem that she had pasted in the first page of her diary. "Labor with what zeal we will, something still remains undone, till at length it is or seems greater than our strength can bear, as the burden of our dreams pressing on us everywhere." And that's from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And yeah, and thanks for letting me share about Susan B. Anthony. She was really a huge inspiration.
Just a simple question. They got the vote, women got the vote in 1920. When did they get the vote here in Canada? Do you know? Was it the same time or later?
I'm not sure. We were just discussing that in the car on the way over, but I'm not as up on. Yeah, I think so, but I'm not sure.
Someone can.
1927. Okay.
Okay. First of all, thank you for choosing this subject and the Sunday Service Committee for choosing Susan B. Anthony. I have long wanted to know about her, and I've never pursued it, and I really appreciated hearing it today. And one of the things that I particularly paid attention to was how she was educated as a woman in the Quaker faith, because my mother grew up as a Quaker. Her family were Quakers. And my mother was always much too outspoken for the context. And I always thought that that was because she just didn't know how to behave. But anyway, as it turned out, it was part of a historical background, so that's kind of funny. But I also thought, as you were speaking, you made reference to Henry Stanton and his support of his wife, and also to Susan's dad. And I think that the lesson that I've learned again and again is that when any group advances, they have people outside their group that support them. And I think women's rights have been certainly due to these, like the women who've worked for them, but in a large part too, it's the men who have supported fair treatment. And so I just wanted to, you know, thank you for including the male role in there too.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was overemphasizing her family involvement, but in researching this, I was reminded a lot of Joanne's presentation about Kurt Vonnegut and how isolated he felt and the lack of support from his family. And to compare that with Susan B. Anthony and to see how much she was capable of doing with the support of the loved ones around her, I think just speaks for itself, really.
Just a comment. feminism is still a dirty F word, isn't it?
It's interesting because doing the research on this, it really becomes evident some of the struggles that we still are facing, and that, like, it made me think about how oppressed women were for so long throughout history, and then by just giving us the vote, that doesn't reverse everything. Like, it doesn't just magically make it all go away. There's still a lot of effort that needs to happen, but it was really incredible. And I also wanted to say, in terms of her connection to the Unitarians, I'll just come to the front. Part of, I think, why it was difficult to find very much about Susan B. Anthony and her Unitarian connections is that she really strived to not distract from her message so much that she didn't even really want to bring up any topic that would turn anyone else away. So she and Elizabeth Stanton actually had a bit of a falling out later on when Elizabeth Stanton felt that religion really took away from the cause of feminism, and that it was kind of like an obstacle that really prevented women from getting their full place in society. But Susan B. Anthony refused to take any position against religion, and she would work with women who were the infidels, who believed in other faiths, and Catholics and Protestants alike, and she really didn't turn anyone away from the cause. Anyway, thank you so much. Oh, okay, sorry.
By the way, Eleanor Roosevelt was against the vote for the women in her early life. But the recent incident with the woman reporter who was, harassed by these men, I think it says something else, the role that men can play when they run across incidents like that, is to stand up and let their voices be heard.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was great. Thank you very much. Yes.